So this is a, I'm Sandy Peterson, and this is a version of a video game instruction, how to get jobs in video games, that was originally intended for a younger audience in Texas. We'll see how well it tracks to a slightly older audience in California. And you are welcome to interrupt at any point. So, who am I? I am Sandy Peterson. I am a game designer. I've been doing video games since 1988, although I actually stopped in 2012 and started doing board games again. But if you don't know, I probably hear y'all know who I am. In the original presentation, they didn't, so I said, look me up. I'm on Wikipedia, mobile games, etc. Here's the sideline. When I found out I was on Wikipedia about 12 years ago, I went and read my article, and I found an error, so I said, oh, I'll fix that. Turns out you're not allowed to edit your own Wikipedia article. So I was not allowed to make any changes to my article because it was about me. So, there now you know. From 2009 to 2011, I taught game development to master's degree students at a fairly prestigious college, and I am no longer the chief creative officer. Well, I guess I kind of still am, but they're not paying me for it. I'm instead the president of Peterson Games. I'm proud to do it. Here's some things I worked on in the video game industry. If you only know me from paper games, you may be impressed or underwhelmed or wish I'd stayed in paper games, but we'll see. So, Civilization, the computer game. I did a lot of work on this. It is, Sid Meier has been on record at least once saying that he hadn't played Civilization the board game before he did this, but he is lying because I personally played Civilization the board game with him in his office more than once before he designed this game. So be aware, okay?
It is crazy.
Doom 1 and Doom 2. This is only a partial spectrum more than video games, but those are probably the most genre-changing games I worked on simply because before Doom 1, no one played games online, head-to-head, over one or anything. And after Doom, they were all doing it. So that made it possible. Quake, which is sort of an offshoot of Doom, and the Age of Empires series, which is the longest period of time I worked in the game company on a long and complex series. It was a lot of fun. I'm very proud of the work I did on that. Thank you. Very proud of the work I did on that. And then there was Halo Wars, which is in a sense a knockoff of Age of Empires, but a science fiction knockoff. And now Cthulhu Wars and others. And however, when you have a career as long as mine, it's nice to show these things, stuff that was successes, but not everything was a success. I'm sure you've all played many years of Dr. Floyd's Wacky Windows, but there it was. And of course, the infamous Darklands, a game so broken that you could not play it for more than an hour without a hard crash to your desktop. The QA guy said, I refuse to sign off on this, and the company president made him do it. A group of us went into the vice president in charge of production, including me, and said, this game cannot be finished by March. It is physically impossible. And we got overruled because it could be, apparently. And we produced it. It went out after March, as we said. Not as much after as we thought it should. Every game crashed, and we had 40,000 returns. It was a glorious victory for our corporate bullheadedness. So, games careers. Is there money in it? Well, yes. I mean, there's. It makes way more money than Hollywood, for example. Partly because of Hollywood, catastrophically tanking in the last decade or so, but also just because games are super big. And this is only in America I'm talking about. If you count worldwide game making, it vastly surpasses movies. Okay, I guess you already know this probably, but there's a lot of gamers that are older, and the numbers keep skewing older as more retired. Like my dad, who is 86 years old, probably spends 4 or 5 hours a day playing StarCraft, so which is an old game, but he likes it, so he's in there playing StarCraft. Is he any good? No, doesn't matter. Having fun playing the game. The game industry hurt us bad. Probably 12 to 15% of us lost our jobs when it first hit, but they all went back. They all got different jobs. That's the genius of the American systems, that your jobs are not safe, but there's a new one waiting around the corner. And the industry is increasing rapidly. There's the big boom in the iPhones and Androids that's helped a lot. When phones finally made it to the point that their games could be fun instead of knockoffs of old Game Boy stuff. Okay, what are the requirements to be in a video game as your career instead of something more logical? First, you must really like games. It would seem to be determined, but it's not. If you want to go into video games just for money, it's stupid. I don't really need to harp on this here because you're at a game convention. But you actually have to like games. And you go into a game company, they actually do things like they ask the accountants and the secretaries when they're hiring if they like and play games. It matters to them that they know about games. Okay? That's a... it's really important to be able to communicate. There is a stereotype of the programmer who can barely talk and can't interact with people, who sits alone in his dark office programming. These guys exist. They're not in game companies because you leave immediately because you have to be able to talk. You have to like to talk. You have to be able to make what you want clearly understood. Okay? If you are a programmer, you can't do it by writing usually, so you have to just talk to them. But the game designers have to be able to write it as well. So communication is a big deal. There's lots of meetings where you're getting together and you can't just inarticulately say, I really feel it should be this way. You have to say, here's why it needs to be this way. Because the other people are generally creative and smart, and you can't buffalo them as easily, which is actually a drawback for me. But, okay, communication, super important. If you like, if your dream job is sitting in a room with your Seth MacFarlane action figures and working alone on a game, it's not going to work in the video game industry. You can still have the Seth MacFarlane figures, I understand, but other people are going to be constantly coming into your office and chewing the rag and asking questions and, oh, we got to go to this meeting and we're going to decide what this next level is going to be like. And so it's communication. It's huge. Obviously, creativity is a big, big help. Maybe not so much if you're an accountant, loving games is enough, but if you actually are trying to create a game, being creative is like a super big help, surprisingly. There are unimaginative people that work in games, and they have to make up for it by surrounding themselves with other creative people and then kowtowing to them. I've worked with a game designer, for example, who I will not name, in the video game industry, who did simulations mostly, you know, like airplanes and tanks, and he actually didn't know what was fun in a game. So I mean, I'm undercutting myself to say this guy wasn't creative, but when he did a game about driving a tank, he said, well, I know there's something fun in driving a tank, but I don't know what it is because I can't tell what's fun. So he simply simulated every single aspect of a tank, knowing that somewhere in there would be the fun. So he had a fully developed how to load the tank gun system, which any logical person would leave out. The fun part is shooting the bad guys, right? And he's like, no, here's how to load the gun, here's how to start the engine, he had everything. And the fun was there too, right? Because you could shoot the bad guys, but that was just, anyway, it kind of hindered him as a designer. And in the game industry, there's also, or in the computer or tech field, this kind of stereotype of the messy guy who's disorganized, who yet does everything because he's a genius. You can be a genius all you want, but you actually have to be organized. Because if you're doing things in the wrong order, or you're not doing the right project, because everything you do has a dependency. Okay? If you decide that you really have to work on the final boss art instead of this of the starting animation, then someone who is depending on the starting animation being their first task is idle and costing the company money and making the game be delayed, and then you all go broke, and then you're sad, and gunshots ring out, and it's all that. So you got to be organized. Your desk doesn't have to look neat, but you have to know what's going on, where things are. Some people who are not as organized do this because they're so genius that they're able to have someone assigned to them to keep them organized that they must then listen to and obey. Okay, so just be aware of that. All right, we're going to go to the next thing. What are the possible careers? Well, more, sorry. First, good news about gaming, about being in the game industry. Okay, we really do work on games all day long. It's not a bunch of paperwork. Okay, I mean, I've had friends that are cops, they say it's all paperwork, right? I have friends that are teachers, I was a teacher, it's all paperwork, right? There's like 2 or 3 hours in the day you're teaching, which is the fun part, and the rest is creating, which is not the fun part. But in games, you're actually working on games all day long. That's all you do. You think about games, you go to lunch, you're talking about games, you go to the bar afterwards, and the guy's getting drinking, talking about games. It's all games. So If that sounds like too much games, maybe it is, but that's what it is. So, and the companies in general have super good benefits. Okay, they have really good healthcare. My wife was amazed when she learned that not every company paid for 100% of the healthcare and 100% of the drugs and all the, well, like legal drugs, right? And there's excellent bonuses. They have giant release parties. People have hand out $100,000 prizes, and it's a huge deal. Okay, so the benefits are really nice. While they do have vacation policies, of course, because they have to, quite often, like for example, when we finished Age of Empires 3, they said, okay, everyone worked Age of Empires 3, take a month off, doesn't count against your vacation, because it's just you need this break from doing this giant, birthing this giant project. So that was kind of cool, right? So that's the kind of thing you get. It's really great. And of course, everyone around you, because of what I said in the previous slide, they have to be creative, right? They have to be organized. They have to be able to communicate, so they're kind of interesting. So one of the rules we had at Ensemble Studios, when we were looking for someone to hire, and the guy got rejected because of this, was, as Greg Street put it, he says, if we were in the elevator on the way down and it broke, and we were trapped in the elevator for 3 hours with this person, would we be having interesting conversations? That was his level. And in general, for almost every single person of the company, the answer was, yeah, I wouldn't mind being trapped in the elevator within 3 hours. I have things to discuss and talk about. So that's the kind of people you have, which is cool. Another reason that the inarticulate anorak, the system in the room, is not desired. Talented award, if you do something good, they know it. They're aware of who did it. Okay, I've read, maybe this isn't true, but I've read in, or seen in shows, read in books, like in ad agencies, there's backstabbing guys who steal your credit. I know for a fact at colleges, there's evil professors that steal credit from their intern stuff, right? This can happen in other industries. The game industry doesn't, they know who did it. They say, this guy was cool, down there low on the totem pole, he was awesome. Okay? Inside the company, then. Outside the company, it all goes to the top guys. All the credit goes to the big guys, right? But which is why you've heard me. But inside the company, they know who did it. Those guys are singled out. And a really good thing that I like that you don't get, if you're, for example, you're a lawyer or something, you get to see your game in a store. You can walk in there and it's right on the shelf. Or it's on Amazon, somewhere it's visible. Okay? And of course, if you're unlucky, you walk into sort of like in the bargain bin. But at least it is a physical object you've produced. Like if you were a carpenter, you know? Or a builder. There's the building you made. There's the chair you made. There's the game you made. It's the same sense of having created something real. So that is not to be trivialized. These are the good things about the game industry. Here's the bad things, okay? With the sad trouble. There's really long working hours some of the time during the crunch time, especially if your company's not well-run, which a lot of them aren't. But Ensemble Studios, they made sure that you were not supposed to work more than 12 hours a day during the crunch time. And crunch time was we tried to keep it down to a month or two. But there's other companies that would do it for 6 to 10, 12 months of crunch time with more than 12 hours. And I know a guy that had MicroProse that after a couple of years of this schedule, he refused to work any more long hours. And I said, dude, we have this project, you have to do it. And he says, see these kids? And I said, yeah, those are your daughters. He says, I don't remember them being the age they are in these photographs because I was working so much. It's never going to happen again. And so long working hours are a thing. And my friend who said he's not going to work the super long hours anymore because he didn't remember his daughters, he didn't, but he took a hit for it in the company. You know, he was willing to take that hit, you understand? And he was such a prestigious guy, he did so much stuff that he was, but that's, be aware of that kind of thing. So, you're in the entertainment business and you're in consumer electronics. Both of those are super volatile, so you put them together and it's like ultra super volatile. And so, like some random vagary of something that happens in Abu Dhabi could make your company go out of business. You have no idea, right? So you don't get to go and work for the same company for 20 years and then retire with a gold watch. You, like, boop, it's gone. Time to go somewhere else. Ensemble Studios got a bullet through its head for internal stock reasons. It was a company that had never failed to sell more than 1 million copies of anything it did, but because the guy in charge of the Microsoft gaming thing, whose name I will not repeat, but his initials are Don Merrick, his stock options were better if he got rid of us and didn't pay for the development of our game for the next 3 years, which would also have been a giant success. But when it was going to be a giant success, that would be right after his term of window for the stock option thing ended. So I don't think he did Microsoft owners good value by firing us, but his personal money was increased. So game companies are volatile, they can go out of business for a good reason. And of course, they're all guys. So if you're single, looking for a girl, they're not going to be at your office. That is a consideration, I know. And here's the sad thing. See, these guys who are creative, they're interesting, they make good money, right? And they cannot find a girl friend. So go figure, you know. There it is. And they don't have to, like, if you work in many companies, there's like, now you are a bureaucrat first class, a bureaucrat second class. You keep working your way up the ranks. There's a whole long corporate structure. In the game industry, there's like, you don't get to be like, you're a designer or you're a lead designer, and that's like, that's it. You don't rise beyond to become something else. It's just like, and because there's only room for like one lead designer per project, then you can have guys who've been in the industry there a long time who are not, who don't get promoted. You know, you don't go up the ranks of merit. You get merited, you get rewarded, you get bigger bonuses. So you can have a guy who's the lead designer in charge of people under him, okay, who are paid far more than he is, because it's not about, because they're being rewarded, but they don't get the same kind of recognition, you know. If you're a designer, you don't go on to become the manager of the company. It makes no sense, because you can't manage a company, you just design games, right? So, okay, and you can't get in a rut because the whole week, I mean, 10 years ago there was like not the phone games, you know. 15 years before that there was not the console games. You just have to, like, your whole world is constantly going around. After Doom came out, suddenly everyone had to adapt to now games are played online and against other people instead of against a computer, and a lot of companies couldn't adapt to that, and a lot of designers and programmers and artists couldn't adapt to that. And you just have to figure out what's happening. You have to be willing to flow with what is happening in the world. You cannot, you know, if you're making cars, you're making cars forever. And if there's a big change in cars, it's maybe we should now have hybrids. Okay? But it's not, they still have wheels, still have engines, there's still giant unions that you have to negotiate with. This doesn't really change that much. But with the gaming world, the world that I'm in gaming now is, I mean, in the 90s, it was all giant corporations making games. In the 80s, it was tiny little guys in their garage making games. Now, again, it's middle-sized guys in their garage making games. It just keeps on, it's like everything about it changes, so that's the deal. Okay, jobs for programmers. If you are a programmer, here is what you need to succeed or know about. Everything in the game is because you did it, right? No one else is making the game work. There's the salaries. Start off about $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. It rises up to $120,000 more. Remember, there's also the bonuses, though. So your salary may only be $120,000, but you may also be getting bonuses of $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 a year. You may be getting other perks. Pay is good. It's possible to get better pay working in some other fields as a programmer, but then you're not working on games with interesting people. You're making an accounting program or something. So it's actually a consideration. That's right, I say here, your projects are dynamic. Every game industry thing is like, for programmers, it's a cutting edge, the most advanced possible programming you can do. At least for most companies I've worked at. You're not just doing boilerplate. So that's appeals to many programmers. And there's a really good job market, because companies are always interested in a good programmer. Even if they don't have a need for one right now, and you come by and they're a good programmer, they'll take you on, like, for future things, because they always want programmers. And the good ones are precious gold. And the ones that are not good or can't play with the other children, like, go away. But then you can get hired somewhere else because they don't know that you don't play with the kids. That's programmers. Next job. Artists. Okay. So, of course, everything you see on the screen is because an artist did it. And one day, one client programmer did some of the art. And what happened to artists, and nowadays, programmers and designers still do some of the art, but not that you ever see. Because what we'll do, one of my tricks as a designer is, I need an icon for something in the game. And the artist says, I'm going to get to it in a couple weeks. So I will make my own icon and put it in. And what that does is it stimulates the artist in rage and horror to stay up that night and change the icon so it's good. So and they know exactly what I'm doing. I said, I just needed an icon. They're like, dude, seriously? Now I have to say a play. He says, you don't have to, but he does. Okay. So salary's not as good as programmers. Still reasonably good. Certainly better than if you're like a freelance artist. There it is. There's a variety of jobs you can have an artist. As an artist, you have to specialize. You're a programmer specialized, so you're not just like a generic artist that does everything. Though they're willing to give you different variable tasks. Generally, if you're an animator, you do animations. If you're a 3D modeler, you do 3D models. If you're an illustrator that does skins or textures, you do that. But they're willing to give you other things just so you aren't in a rut. But you have your job, and there it is. You start a little lower than the... this is guys right out of school I'm talking about. Then it rises up. Okay. Generally, they are pickier about artists than programmers or designers. It might be because currently artists are more of a glut on the market. I'm not sure. It might be because programming sounds hard, so people don't want to do it. And art, like all the kids in school like my art, so I can do art. But anyway, there's more artists. It's harder for them to get a job. It's probably part of the reason they have a lower salary at start. But... like at the Guild Hall, we graduated artists, producers, programmers, and designers, and we had like a 96% overall hire rate by game companies, but the artists were like 15%. Not 15%, 85%. So it was still high because the Guild Hall was awesome, but it's lower than the others. The programmers were like 100%. Everyone was a programmer. So be aware. Okay, designers. There's one there. The reason that you play it is, of course, because the designer made it fun. That's what they do. Programmers make it work, artists make it visible, designers make it fun. Salaries are intermediate between artists and programmers. Some designers will go higher. I did, because I was so senior, but there's the salary range. A lot of designers, because you can't like go out of school with a design credential, right? A lot of designers start as an artist or a programmer, then move into design. There's also a new paradigm where you can start as like a level designer, and then as a level designer you can become a non-level designer or not. But to be a designer, well, designers have to do the most different things. Like artists do art, designers do art too, programmers do scripting, designers do scripting too, and designers write letters and they do organizational charts and they draw things on the wall and they do the widest range of stuff. And they are the guys, like when you're getting together to play a game at lunch, they're the ones that are leading the charge to play the game because the designers really like games even more than the programmers. And the designers are willing to play games that aren't computer games. And eventually they can get the artists and programmers in on that too. So we had the programmers playing pitch car every day at the Ensemble Studio. So designers, they love the games and they are... Okay, there's one more task, or two more tasks. There's being a producer, which didn't used to be a task, because the designer was supposed to also be the producer. And it turned out that designers sucked at being producers, so we got real producers. And the purpose of the producer is not... the producer is a purely position, because management views him as management. But the team views him as part of the team, unless, of course, he's a total tool, in which case no one listens to him and he fails as a producer. He's got to be part of the team primarily. Okay, he's got to let management know he's doing it. His job isn't to make the guys. His job is not making the project move faster and cost less. His job is making the project move. Okay, and doing it what the right speed is. You know, if you have the right kind of producer and he says, "How long will you do X?" and you say 6 weeks, okay, then he doesn't look at you and say, "You've got 4." He'll look at you and says, "Do you need 8 or is 6 the actual number?" And you're not lying to me because he wants to know the real numbers. Okay, so without a producer, your project would die. He gets you the things you need. He does like really low-level stuff too. For example, we're staying in late because it's crunch time. I will make sure we have dinner. No one wants Chinese, right? Because we had that last week in a row. And then that's the kind of thing he does. You got Chinese. Make sure you got things to go. He makes sure all those things work and run. And salaries vary. About the same as a designer, really. They can actually rise to upper management, unlike the other guys in the company. You can have a producer go up and become company VP. That doesn't happen with designers or programmers. And the thing is that if you're a brand new producer out of school, like, no one really wants you. They only want, like, a producer who's been doing it for a long time. Okay, because each project needs, like, one producer, and but it needs multiple designers and multiple, so you don't need that many producers, and they only want the good ones. And so there it is. Producers, probably the worst job market of them all, but if you can get a job, then you're cool, right? But then you go to another company, and you're like, do you need a producer? Because I lost my old company and exploded. And they're like, well, not really. You know, we're cool without it. But if you're a designer, they snap you up. Or a programmer, or other. Testers! This is the job that everyone thinks is the, well, at least if you were 13, you'd think it was the cool job. But here's how it works. So testers actually play games all day long. It's not really very fun because they do not play fun games. They play games that are busted and not working and that crash and lock up, because that's why you're testing it, to find out where the lockup is. So we would say, Frank, you must play this game. We have to get 60,000 arrows in the air as you're attacking the city to see if that's what's causing the crash. Please do so, and do so all day long. You're also working only on games that are, by definition, in the final stage of production when everyone's crunching because they're trying to get the game finished. So you have to crunch, and then when you finish that game, then you're on the final stages of the next game, because that's always where you are. So you're always in the worst, longest, most arduous part of doing the game, working on broken games. When you walk into the programmer with a bug, they glare at you like you're a cockroach because they hate having you find bugs. The designers love you. They love finding bugs. But the programmers hate you. And the salaries are sucky, okay? I mean, $20,000 a year for a tech industry is, like, not to be impressed. I don't think. Okay? On the other hand, you don't need much training, right? A lot of them come out of high school and say, I want to be a tester. I say, great. Over here. Here's your sandwich. Start working. Okay? The job market's not great. No one looks for an experienced tester. They just find some other guy right out of college and say, bring him on. Now, high school kids, we have found, are the worst ever at testing games because they are incapable of communicating. Okay? So you need people college age or more so they can actually talk. Because the college kid is like, how did you like the game? It was good, I guess. You can't even get feedback from those guys. But the game tester, of course, has to be articulate. He has to have all the talents that we mentioned earlier. And then he also has to be willing to work for almost no money. And also, you're the one fired first. Because in a pinch, the designers and programmers and artists can test it. And they do. They have to. Designers spend a lot of time testing. But you spend all your time, so they're just like, well, the designers and artists, you guys spend more time testing than you were, and we'll get rid of these guys. So, another reason that the first to go is because they usually have the shortest term guys in the company. They haven't been around for a long time. Eventually they wise up and stop trying to make a career out of testing and do something else. But okay, so testers. Okay, if you want to be a programmer, you need a degree in programming. If you don't have a degree, then you must be able to show your programming somehow, okay? I know in the movies it shows programmers in their basement and learning on the internet, and that actually was true back in like 1980 or 1990. It's not true now. You have to actually know math and know specific programs. And they can't end with a programmer. The way they test you is they actually will ask you questions. They'll grill you. They're senior programmers, and they will grill you with questions about what you can do. And so you have to be ready to do that. It's like defending your thesis, you know, they just go through it. Because the thing is, you can't just show them a program and say, look how cool my program is, because they don't know for a fact that you did that program. Because you can't tell, right? And it's like, could have been eight guys working on the program, who knows? So the grilling is how you get your job as a programmer. Artists, you need a portfolio. They don't care if you went to school or not, because your portfolio shows them if you got the chops. You show them your imagery, you have a website, you have your specialty texturing or whatever, and you need to use a 3D program. Everything's 3D now. I guess not everything. The iPhone is not all 3D, but they're probably going to go that way again eventually. And even on the iPhone, a lot of things are still 3D. They're going 3D. So there it is. The portfolio is the key to success. I could not drill this into my students' heads. I want to get an A in this class. I said, no one, it's fine to get an A in the class. I'm a teacher, right? He says, no one in the game industry cares if you got an A in my class or if you got an F in my class. All they care about is that you have art they can use. It's only if you can do it. And the only reason they care about the bachelor's degree and program is because they see that you got a degree, they know you had to do some basic things to accomplish that. But then it all is answering the questions. Designers are harder because it's like a programmer, it's hard to show your work. And but they can't ask you questions. They can't ask you programming questions about how you would do this search function or something, right? What do you say? How would you design this game to these subsystem? And that's not, how do you evaluate if you designed it good or not, you know? So generally the way they do it is you have to show them that you know how to use the commercial design tools, that you have some art chops, that you have some scripting chops. Look, I did this level for Gears of War, and there's a locust dancing in it that I scripted. And they go, oh, cool, you have a dancing locust. That shows you have some scripting abilities. Okay? That kind of thing. But it's hard. Designers are actually, of all these three groups, the ones that are hardest to demonstrate they have skills. Of course, if you have done some levels, then that can help. But then they have to play through the level. As an artist, you can just flip through the portfolio and say, oh, this is good, bad, good, good, bad. The designer, they have to play through your whole stinking level, and then they'll find something you did wrong. Okay, programmers. Basically, here you need, not programmers, producers, a business degree. More programming you know, the better for you. I've never known a producer in the game industry that did not know some programming. So it's not just being a guy that does charts on the wall. Okay, testers, yay! You can be one now. Go sign up. Okay, because I originally did this project mostly for people in Texas, it emphasizes that. I'm not really familiar with what many of the schools in California are like for this, but regardless, I will back this up as the best video game education in the world. It gives you a master's degree, it teaches all the categories, and unlike many game training groups, the Guildhall forces you to work with the other disciplines to make games. So there's the artists and the programmer designers are working as a team, they're making an actual game to a certain level. You start making a little simple like flash game, then you have to do a mod of a game, then you have to do your whole game. And so by the time you get to the Guildhall, you spend a long time if you're a designer, for example, you've worked with artists, you've worked with programmers, you've worked with producers, you've had a deadline, you've done all this stuff. And so that's why we have the 96% higher rate, okay? UCF has a program directly modeled on the Guildhall, as in they sent people to the Guildhall and watched us, and they went back and set up their own. So it's pretty much identical.
Where's SMU? Sorry.
SMU is in Dallas. It's Southern Methodist University. It was originally founded by the Methodists. It's completely secular. Well, they do have like a religious, you can get training for a pastor, right? And they have a church on campus. But aside from that, it's just a university, right? Recently, it got a coup. It got the George Bush Presidential Library. So they have a big old library and with all the records for his 8 years as president, which is actually, whether you like it or not, a cool thing to have because it's historically important. They have a really good law school. They're mostly a business law school, but they set up the Guildhall at a little satellite campus, and it was really good. So anywhere else? Yes, there's tons of other places. Texas, UT Dallas has a game design course. There's art institutes all over the place. Some of them are good, some of them are sucky. Wash them. Full Sail is like super sucky, so I advise you to avoid it. You'll see its ads everywhere. Here's a lot of other things. A lot of film school, like the Vancouver Film School, is really good for also learning game stuff that you need to know. The Sheridan is spectacular for an artist. That's really, really good. The guys at Sheridan go to like Disney, and we hired guys from the Sheridan who had been at Disney, who like after their year toiling at Disney, they like, okay, you got the good resume, leave in Disney because it's bad. It's good to work at. It's good to have worked at Disney. It's bad to be working at Disney. So, okay. And USC has a pretty good one. Anyway, there's other corporations. Basically, you have to look around. And the thing is, you look at how many faculty have the game design department. If they have, like, three guys and they all have other tasks besides game development, like they're also teaching film appreciation or something, then probably that's not really a strong school. One of the things about the Guildhall is our teachers, all of us are like adjuncts or associate teachers at the Guildhall. I'm not one there anymore because none of us got PhDs in doing games, because we all were actual game industry professionals. So, of course, the snooty school guy said, well, you don't have a PhD in doing games. I said, well, how can I? I'm the only one qualified to teach it. You know, so I just had to be an associate or a junk, right? I didn't have the badge of being an educator, but of course you can get useful skills from schools that aren't teaching game development. So you have to look at the school as a whole. Like programming, you don't necessarily have to go to a game development thing to learn. And going to the Guildhall, for example, to get to the Guildhall and get your master's degree in programming and game development, you actually already have to know how to program. They didn't teach you more programming for games, but when you go in there, you got C++ down, you know how to program, you know how to do the stuff, and then they give you the specifics to be a game guy. With designers, it's like, we know we didn't have any design stuff before we came here because no one teaches it, so that's more from the ground up. But okay, questions? Any questions about the video game industry and working in it, or gaming in it, or playing in it, or visiting it, or anything about it?
Are there any online schools that are worth a damn?
No. No online schools are worth a damn. Don't waste your money on them. I take it back. Online schools are awful, but there are...
Sorry, I meant online programs.
There are you can go online and you can go into if you have a question about developing and you go onto the forums for like Unreal or something, they're super helpful. Or you can take the tutorials for Unreal or Gears of War, and those are really good. But I'm talking about self-taught stuff, right?
Mm.
Okay, those are good. You can do that if you have the right kind of personality. But trying to get an online degree is a big waste of time, in my opinion.
Diploma mills. That pretty much right there.
Well, they pretend to teach you, and they have game industry guys. I don't know. It is like, yeah, and they're Full Metal, right? And the thing is that in the industry, they know if they see you have a degree from Full Sail, then they know, right? That not only are, but you're a guy that really has stars in your eyes, you want to be in the industry, and you're gullible. That's what they know, right? So.
Okay. How have the timelines for game development changed over
there? They have gotten shorter with the development of iPhone games. But of course, the big sensor games, if you're doing Call of Duty, that still is years in the making. But even an iPhone game takes months. I mean, if you look at a game really as simple as Angry Birds, right? And look how many people are on the credits, okay? That many people don't work on a project for 2 months and then be done. That was a hefty thing. The other guys are working together, they're having those meetings, the producer's bringing them in supper, you know, they're arguing with the testers for finding too many bugs, the game designers saying find more bugs, so all that stuff is happening, right? So yeah, timelines are still long, much longer than board games.
What about doing an app game like that, especially even if it's like a clone of an already existing game, like if you're doing like a Binding of Isaac or like a Rogue clone, because those are pretty easy to do, as kind of your entrance way into the video game industry.
You could use that as a as your resume, kind of, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's basically what we did at the Guildhall, is we made them design 3 games, and then they had a resume with these, not only with games, but also with like levels they produced or art they've done or little extra programs, and they can show that. So essentially, that's what we had them do. You could do that and say, look, I did this little game, but if it's a little easy game to do, the thing is they'll know. They're game industry guys. This is the kind of thing they did when they were in high school, right? So they're aware of how hard it is to do. So while it shows you have dedication, they may not pay as much attention to it as you wanted. They'll say, okay, cool, you really like games, you did this little game. And if you show it to them, they say something clever, and oh, that was clever, you know? Or if there's a programming trick you can explain to them, they'll get that, okay? I mean, it's as valuable as you make it be, essentially. They aren't going to really probably look at sales. I mean, if it sells really well, why would you go work for them, right? You just grab the money. In general, one of the problems with the iPhone is it's really hard for people to find your game, because there's a million of the games buried in the completely unorganized. I mean, Amazon's way better organized, right? The iPhone App Store is impossible to find today. So you have to know what you're searching for. You can't just I want to look for games that are like horror-based shooters, and there's no way of doing that. So,
yeah.
Yes. It's a design opportunity.
Just curious, so who has the market share in terms of programming languages as well as maybe design programs?
It's pretty much all C++.
C++?
Yeah. Okay. Not in the iOS, right? You mean like Unity?
Well, I'll turn to
they love Unity, right?
Well, I'm just trying to decide, like, programming languages was programs maybe as...
here's the thing. Because the languages change, because now there's Unity that we must all learn, and before there was C++ that we had to all learn, and before that there's something else, the important thing is to know the basics of how to program. And then whatever language is hip, you like move into that and you change it over. But knowing how to program means you can go into Unity and do it. Right? Does that make sense? Right now, knowing Unity is good. Okay. Knowing C++ is always good because it's always, well, maybe it won't always be there, but it's been there for like 20 years and probably be there 20 years more. So, does that answer your question? Or?
And how about design programs? Like designing type, like artist tools?
Like what?
Software. I'm just thinking in terms
what design software? I don't even want to... you mean like Gears of War or something?
What do they actually use in the industry? Maybe.
Okay, what designers use in the industry for designing the games?
What's the market share, I guess?
The market share is 0%. Because what you always use as a designer is the proprietary design program that the programmers on this particular project cobbled together for you. Okay? You don't use a commercial general program. You use... You're doing this game. Here's the program that the programmers give you these paradigms for your scripting. They give you these paradigms for production, and then you go and use that. So there's no overarching program that goes from company to company. It's just whatever they give you in this. Even if you're using Unity, and the programmers use Unity, they'll say, okay, you're going to use Unity to build your level, and you're going to use these parts of Unity that I will structure for you and program for you. And you just use those. So you're just gonna just use. So designers are very. So like when we did Quake, okay, we used a program that we called QuakeEd or Quaked is what it looked like. QUAKED, right? And so we're using Quaked, and it was designed by John Carmack. And immediately after Quake was released, there was like 6 commercial programs for editing Quake, every single one of which had more power and more ability and more stuff than our program did. Okay, same happened with Doom. We used Doom. And as soon as Doom was done, everyone had better programs. But we didn't. We had the program because Carmack does our program, we always use the, and that's the reason the program, it doesn't start with all the features. Where I'm designing levels in Ancient Empires, right? And I'm doing the levels and doing stuff and saying, man, I really need something in order to be able to place an object that enemies are attracted to. You know, can I have that? And he says, no, we'll get to that eventually. And then like 3 months before the game's over, hey, we got to go to make that object. You want to go back to all your old things and change all of the adventure so I can use it? And like, holy crap, dude. I needed this 8 months ago. And then you go in and you try to put it in. But of course, when the commercial version comes out, that ability's there from the start. Right. You're awesome. I can plot these plinths down. I can do all this stuff. Okay? And then there's another thing, like the Easter eggs that you get in programs. There's 2 sources of them. One is more common source is that you need to have a cheat code as the designer so you can get to the end of the stupid level and get on with the game and test things. So those cheat codes stay in as an Easter egg. The other source is near the end of the project, the artists don't have much to do because they don't really have bugs like programmers. The programmers are busy, are tanked. They're working hard. Designers have a lot of work. Artists don't. So they draw weird things for the game because they're still on the project. And then those weird things, they go to a programmer who's struggling trying to fix that damn bug where all the tanks go into the middle of the ocean and sink. One of the bugs we had in one of our games, for example. And they said, can you put this bust of Abraham Lincoln jumping around smashing people? And he goes, sure. And he puts in a code and then it's in. So that's where Easter eggs come from, those 2 things. Okay. Oh, actually, 1 more source. Designers pranking the programmers. Because the designers will put things in our levels that we think the programmers won't find them. And then, like, sometimes they do. And then they say, why do you have a programmer of me? Why do you have my head on a stick in this level, in a secret room that you can't get to without cheat codes? And I was like, well, it seems like a good idea. So that's exactly what I did. In the final level of Quake, John Romero's head is on the stick.
Right.
And that was me putting his head on the stick. And the artist came and said, I love that. He put an animation, so when you shoot it, it is a pain animation. So, and John found it before release. He was zipping through the level, cheating his way to see things, and he got a glimpse of his head and said, "Whoa!" And he goes back, "What the heck is this?" He's like, "What did you do here?" And I said, "Well, me and Adrian wanted to put your head on a stick and level." And of course, he loved it, right? But
where did the Cobra car come from?
Oh, the Cobra car. That was okay. What happened is that Adrian Carmack bought a Cobra. Okay. And what happened is John Carmack loves hot cars. He bought a Ferrari, right? He had nitro in it. Okay, he could snap his drive shaft anytime he wanted by popping the clutch. Okay, and he was like a super overpowered. So John Romero is like, I want to be cool like Carmack, so he buys himself a Ferrari too. So there's two Ferraris in the parking lot. There's Carmack's super hopped up Ferrari, and John Romero's like bare bones Ferrari. It looks like Carmack's, but he didn't know anything about cars. He just like got it because it would look cool. Then one day we're up in the office, and we look out the window, and there's a Cobra. We're like, holy crap, what's that? How did we get a Cobra? So we all go downstairs, and then we find that Adrian Carmack had bought a Cobra. Yeah. And so we all go downstairs, and we're like, a Cobra, oh my gosh! And the funny thing is, John Romero got like jealous. Look, I have a cool car too. And you want to look at my Ferrari? He said, dude, you've had your Ferrari for like 6 months. We want to see the Cobra. John Romero was like a little kid in a lot of ways. It was really funny. So it was pretty funny. But Adrian was a really stand-up guy. But before, the reason his car didn't come for 8 months, because first, with the money we got from Doom, he bought his mom a house. So, okay. Other questions about the industry? Yes, sir.
So, in between your time in board games and video games, which did you enjoy more? And in terms of production, which one is more challenging to actually get a finished product?
I am currently enjoying board games much more than I enjoy video games. And the video games are much more challenging to get to a project. A video game is more complex than the most complicated board game. They are really, really in-depth. That's why there's teams of 40 and 50 people working for a year on this thing. Age of Empires 3 costs like $10 million to produce. Okay, I mean, it sold 3 million copies at like $7 a whack, so it made back its money. But it was really long and hard. Now, of course, some way it's scaled down because in the board game industry, like, sales are way less. Like, I produced 10,000 copies of Cthulhu Wars as opposed to 3 million. But on the other hand, I split the money among a lot smaller pot, but it takes less time to do. I can design a board game in a shorter time. The real thing I like as a designer about board games is that when I'm doing a video game, if I find something that's wrong I need to fix, I have to go to a programmer and get a build. We'll do the next build on Wednesday, okay? And here's the changes, and then I find something else halfway through and they can't change it yet. With a board game, the very next time I play it, I can say, by the way, add +1 to all your sixes or something. I mean, it's really easy to fix it, so I like that. So I like the board games better. But that said, I would say it's likelier that people are able to get careers and have salaries and raise a family with the video game industry, video game playing. I would not be able to survive with my board company right now if I had not had the extra infrastructure and cash influxes from my video game career to help support the board game during the early financially tiresome times.
So do you do any automated tests? For instance, like an asymmetric game like a Cthulhu Wars, how do you balance that out?
From board game?
Yeah, from board
game. I take it to people and say, play this game. Just play the game and I watch it. And I can't take notes. So play it again with different things and I watch it. I don't have any automated system. I mean, I sometimes I'll do an automated system for like running a million combats online. Mm-hmm. But that's not the same. It doesn't show you how the game balance works. The reason I'm able to balance Cthulhu Wars was frankly because one of my jobs at Ensemble Studios was to be the guy that balanced Age of Empires and Age of Kings and Age of the War Chiefs and all these things. I had to make sure they were balanced and the factions all fit. And so an Ensemble Studios had a peculiar balance system that was probably the best in the entire game industry. And I adopted that, which is you playtest and playtest and playtest like crazy every single moment. You have anything that can barely go on screen, there's guys testing it every day, constantly. And so I brought that over to board games, so I test my games longer than most board games. And on the other hand, I need to because they're more asymmetrical, and so it's easier to find in a balance. I mean, if you're playing Ticket to Ride, there's not really game balance, right? It's just if the game's fun or it works. But with an asymmetrical game like Twilight Imperium or Eclipse or Cthulhu Wars, you have to test. So I do. Yes?
So what has the rise of the freemium and in-app payment in, business model done to the design of games? I mean, I assume that warps.
It is, yeah, it does warp. It makes corporate guys follow clicks on numbers and make you, like, the thing is that what the guys in charge of the company want is to make lots of money. And really, on one level, that's what you want to, right? I mean, we all want to make enough money to be able to support our eventual shift to the board game industry, right? So the thing is, they say, well, if we make him pay for more stuff, we'll make more money. And the more things, and of course, the problem is kind of like the argument of, well, you know, if I cut one leg off a frog, it still jumps almost as far, and cut another leg off, it still jumps as far, and then the third leg, it jumps 75% as much. So when I cut the fourth leg off, it should be 50% as much, but it's not. It like doesn't jump at all, right? So that's kind of how it works. Is as you add on annoying clicks and extra crap you have to buy, at some point the players like say, I'm going to play something else, right? And so with companies that do that, okay, like Farmville, okay, then you have the constant war between the producers, managers, the developers that are trying to get the most money possible, and the designers and developers who are trying to have the game be as popular as possible. Okay, and there's a level at which you're making more money, but it's getting less popular, and then there's like this, it's kind of like with taxes. Like if the government had taxes that were 100%, they would make zero money, because nobody would do any work, right? And if the government had 0% taxes, they would also make zero money, because they wouldn't get any of it. So you have to like figure out where that balance is, and it's probably not a 50% taxation, right? The curve probably isn't an even curve, you know, I guess, right? But that's kind of the idea behind the games, too. The more you burden you put on the players, the less they like the game, and at some point it breaks down, and we haven't figured out yet where that burden lies.
I was going to say, the analogy we used was you have a candle that has multiple colors, and you burn a candle normally, and the wax melts really cool, and it's awesome, you know? But you gotta it takes a long time for the wax to all melt. But if you take a blowtorch and hit it, you get a charred mess.
Who, in your opinion, as far as a major game publisher right now, has kind of struck the best balance? Is there anybody that particularly stands out?
Robot Entertainment is really good. Gearbox is really good.
Gearbox?
Yeah, I would say Robot and Gearbox are good. Robot did Orcs Must Die,
yeah.
Hero Academy, Gearbox, of course, Borderlands. Those guys are pretty sharp, I would say. There's other companies which are steeped in evil, like Electronic Arts. Electronic Arts, don't get me wrong, like Disney, it's a terrific place to have on your resume. You work at Electronic Arts, they know you can walk the walk. But they also know that you're really glad to be gone from there, because the internal struggles and the backbiting and the character assassination, I mean, it's like, they have, every year at Electronic Arts, they have giant meetings where they get all the producers together and teach them how they all must work together for the corporate good and be cooperative, and every game produces and helps, and it never has a single event. They're legendary for their feuds. of the producers. So programmers don't care, right? And the artists don't care, and the designers don't care, but the producers are like titanic clashes of like Stalin versus Hitler, right? Except the Stalin versus Hitler weren't quite as nasty in the way they programmed, like talking about the other guy. But
because the style that seems to be taking off right now, at least for my observable universe, is the one where it's like the League of Legends from Riot or Hearthstone from Blizzard.
Blizzard's a pretty good place to work too.
Is it?
Blizzard's cool, yeah. Okay. They're cool.
Where it's a free to play game, but then you can basically either deck out your character.
Yeah, we are in the industry. We are still struggling with how to make money with games. People don't go down to the store anymore and buy a game. So it's a different world. We got to figure out how in this new world we do it. And we know if we give everything away for free, we'll make zero money. And if we make everything cost $1,000 a day, we'll make zero money. Where is the limit? And that's where the clash comes. And it may turn out eventually be dynamic and balanced, that is constantly going back and forth, like wildcat populations versus rabbits. But it's also possible eventually we'll figure out how it's supposed to be. Like for example, I was actually involved in one of the industry changing things. Now it's an obsolete one, but with Doom, where we gave away the first few levels free, then you had to buy the game, you know, and that like that worked like a charm. It also made the game pirated everywhere in the world, right? So the advantage of Hearthstone, one of the things is that you can't really pirate Hearthstone, you have to go online and play with their dudes, right? And so that was always an issue with other games that we went to China and found copies of Age of Empires in Chinese, like not authorized by us. Some guy, and he made nicer boxes than we had. We're selling them in China with all this stuff, right? Not right China, this is Hong Kong, this is Taiwan, right? Supposedly non-communist country. And so we went to them and said, we want to sell our game in Chinese. And we need to hire these guys to do it. turn them back to the cause of goodness by having them sell it for us. You get weird things coming in from the guys on top who don't understand how things work. Here's a story about that. I'm working on The Conquerors. Anyone remember The Conquerors for Age of Games? You do.
Yeah.
Okay, so The Conquerors, yeah. So I'm the guy in charge, but I'm the lead designer, and I say, okay, we're going to have cool conquering armies in this. The Huns, right? Everyone knows they conquered. And the Spanish, they kicked ass for years, right? And then the Aztecs, who were also conquerors, plus they used someone fun for the Spanish to fight. And we need someone else for the Spanish for the Aztecs to fight. So the Mayans, who were maybe not conquerors exactly, but against both the Aztecs and the Spanish, someone fun to fight in their cool country. So we make these ends. So we get these, they're all designed, ready to go in. And just before we're going to release the game, Microsoft personally calls me. And I have to go to the office with my producer, and they say, we need you to put Koreans in the game.
What?
And I said, I love Korea, but like, not conquerors, right? I mean, they sat in Korea, to their credit, right? You know? And they said, no, we have to have Koreans. I said, why do I need to add Koreans at this, at like, 2 months before the game is out?
Game.
And they said, because StarCraft sold 6 million to 3 million copies in Korea. I said, StarCraft doesn't have any Koreans in it. There's no Koreans in StarCraft. No, there's not Koreans. So I had to go, okay, fine. I mean, it was crazy head stuff, right? So I went back, I put in the Koreans, you know, and made them cool, and they became like one of the most popular guys. But it was just like, but the logic was like not there at all. You know, it was like this. Because the reasoning made no sense to me. Right?
But who's buying the game? Who's playing the game? Because they actually have like game shows where they actually play like StarCraft.
No, I know. Koreans are a huge game monger. But StarCraft, there's no Koreans in StarCraft. That's not why they bought it.
I think they sold 6 million copies.
But that's the reasoning of the bean counter.
Yeah, but the bean counter, that's the thing.
Yeah, who's playing the game, who's buying it?
And there's add more stuff. Don't want to have this fun thing, but as a game designer, what I learned is I want to have like growth in the game where things get better, but it's got to be fun in the very first 5 minutes.
Yes.
The very first bit has to be fun, okay? And the bean counters don't want it to be fun at the first because they want you to pay for all the fun. And that's the fight you have. Like an example of a game that was fun from the very start. This is really old. Anyone remember F-15 Strike Eagle from like 1987? Okay. So I worked for MicroProse for 5 years, right? That's where I did Civilization. So in F-15 Strike Eagle, one of the things they did is you start off, you don't have to take off your plane. You're already in the air flying, right? And in the first like 30 seconds, a MiG goes right in front of you. And all you got to do is push the button on your controller and shoot it down with your nose gun. And everyone like, hey, I shot down the plane, and everyone loved that. Then from there, so that's a regular game. But the first 30 seconds, this guy shoot down, and that was game design, in my opinion. That was Andy at his best. Andy being, by the way, the programmer that I said that refused to work long hours anymore because, like, he didn't know his kids. So
yeah, was more important after a certain stage.
He literally went on to Origins. And worked for them, and then he went to EA, and he actually prospered to EA because he changed his corporate culture to the dark side. That's what you have to do, right? I mean, Don Matrick, the guy that murdered Ensemble Studios, said we had come from EA, right? So when he went to Microsoft, we said, well, you know, he's EA, so he knows the industry, but we're suspicious that he would be a murderous, but intelligent as any of us, right? So that's why you will never see the giant MMO that Ensemble Studios was going to do in science fiction space. That I was going to design the entire back history and universe of. And I made a lot. I did a lot of it, but it's dead. So now I'm doing Cthulhu Wars instead, which is more fun anyway. Any other questions? Are we done?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.